This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Rachel Mealy. It's a special edition of our show today. We're going to delve deep into one of the biggest police operations in history. The three-year sting was codenamed Ironside in Australia and Trojan Shield in the United States.
Police search warrant, open the door!
It was the sting of the century. Global organised crime figures were tricked into using an app that was secretly controlled by the FBI.
Remarkable in how it was conceived, remarkable in how they got the opportunity and decided to capitalise on it so quickly.
The Australian Federal Police joined agencies in 17 other countries as underworld figures across the globe unwittingly revealed their plans.
The biggest police sting in Australian history. Today, we learnt of Operation Ironside. A secret three-year
delivered a massive blow to organised crime in New Zealand as part of a major international operation.
It's been called the world's most sophisticated sting, a three-year global operation to infiltrate organised crime using an encrypted app.
It was a masterful scheme on an unimaginable scale. Years of police work culminating in this. 800 people arrested in more than a dozen countries. At least 250 of those were in Australia alone. More than $50 million in cash was seized, as well as 32 tonnes of illicit drugs. And overall, it's seen the disruption of key criminal figures and organised gangs. It's been called Operation Ironside at home, but globally, it's got the very apt name Trojan Shield. That's a reference to the key bit of technology that's helped ensnare some of the world's most wanted criminals. Catherine Gregory has been covering the story and she's here with me now. KG, it's a hell of a story, isn't it? And it continues to unfold.
That's right, Rach. It's got all the elements: crime, dramatic arrests and secret surveillance, and it's escalated even today. So last night there was a drive-by shooting in Sydney's CBD and underworld figure Bilal Hamzi was murdered. It's believed to be the result of feuding families and criminal gangs, but police said they think there's also a link to Operation Ironside. Here's New South Wales Police Detective Superintendent Rob Critchlow.
Our Deputy Commissioner last week forecast that we'd see some increased violence after the resolution of Operation Ironside and the impact that's had on a number of criminal groups in Sydney, and this appears to be a possible result of that. We are still investigating, of course, and working close with our partners. It's vital to remember the harm that these groups are causing to our community. The violence that they prosecute through their business practices makes our Sydney city a less safe place, and we can't stand for that, and we will not stand for that.
But what's really fascinating about all of this is how police captured these criminals in the first place. You see, they used modern technology to infiltrate and monitor the everyday activities of these old school underworld figures and their networks. They did this via an encrypted app called Anom. See, it was put on thousands of criminals' phones. In fact, 300 syndicates across 100 countries were using it. And it was as a way to communicate about their activities, you know, things like drug trafficking, money laundering, hits on other criminals, that sort of stuff. Criminals have been using encrypted messaging technology to do their business for some time, but it's often eluded police. Not this time, though.
And KG, why is that? What did police do differently?
So police were covertly tracing the millions of messages between those that had been using the app. And that's because the app worked like a Trojan horse. It was actually developed by the FBI in the US with the help of a police informant back in 2018. And then with the help of the Australian Federal Police, the FBI then planted it among criminal networks. How? Well, imagine it's like social media influencers. Police used undercover agents to give trusted underworld figures the devices to promote and distribute. And one of those influencers is actually a well-known Sydney drug kingpin, Hakan Ayik. He's one of Australia's most wanted men, and he was very well known in Sydney, in the Sydney underworld through the 90s and early 2000s. He grew up in Sydney's southern suburbs and continued to have quite a presence there later on. But it's been reported that he was also really well known around another area that lots of other underworld figures frequented. That's King's Cross. It's Sydney's red light district, although it isn't what it used to be. Back in the 80s, 90s and early 2000s, Bikie gangs essentially ruled the streets. You see, they ran most of the clubs along the main strip. I actually went and visited one of the clubs just around the corner.
And right now I'm standing outside what used to be called the Lincoln Club. It's on Bayswater Road, just around the corner from the main strip of King's Cross. And this Lincoln Club was actually owned by Comancheros bosses. And apparently Hakanayak was a frequent visitor here. He was actually known as the right-hand man of some of the former Comancheros bosses. But right now it's just looks like a standard bar and restaurant, so very much a different gentrified place to what it used to be.
King's Cross, you say, now has a lot of fancy wine and cocktail bars and boutiques and expensive homes. But some King's Cross old-timers remember the days when the bikies were in control. So I had a chat with some of them.
And do you remember when the bikies owned all the nightclubs?
It was great. There was plenty of money, plenty of people, plenty of drugs, sex, drugs, rock and roll. Yeah.
If you weren't from here and you walked up here, you might get a bit, this is, full on. But if you're not used to it, it's not scary. Sweet.
The locals watched the locals back then, in those days.
Do you remember a guy called Hakanayak? Did you ever come across him?
The bikies, they're all there. But him, I can't personally remember,
And what about just the Comancheros and Angels that were all around?
They were all quite friendly.
Yeah.
That was sweet. But now there's nothing up here at bikies. Now there's no bikies at all.
So some leaders of these bikie gangs, like the Comancheros, have actually ended up overseas, fleeing police. Hakanayak also fled Australia in 2010 when police were trying to nab him, allegedly in connection to a $230 million heroin importation bust. It's been reported that he's actually been operating in Istanbul in Turkey in recent years.
So do we know any more about what he's up to at the moment?
Well, police are urging him actually to return to Australia for his own protection. They're saying he's a marked man, given he inadvertently helped distribute this app that helped police capture the hundreds of criminals around the world and also provided them this window into the criminal underworld. There's concern too about reprisals between these underworld figures, which might already be kicking off, as we heard earlier. Meanwhile, though, police just continue to hunt down the people that have been ensnared in this sting. And there's been more arrests of alleged criminals in just the past day, so the operation will continue to unfold.
Catherine Gregory reporting there. Well, Operation Ironside has underlined the scale of Australia's illicit drug trade. It's been revealed that mafia figures, bikie gangs and international drug cartels have been working together to import the deadly cargo. The Australian Federal Police's Commander of Investigations in New South Wales is Kirsty Schofield. I spoke to her a short time ago. Commander Schofield, what's been the impact of Operation Ironside on major crime in Australia so far?
The impact has been significant. We've arrested, numerous people. We're up to 250 people that are now in jail. So there's an instant impact to have those, criminal figures off the streets. We have had an impact on their lifestyles. We have taken their assets. We've taken their money, anything that's proceeds of the crime. But we've also been able to map out the criminal networks. We have a much better position of who is connected to who and actually how they do their business. So,
yeah, I'm really interested in that side of criminal networks. Do you think that the effects are ricocheting through those networks already?
Yeah, I think so. I think they've got to be really nervous. They had such a level of comfort in this platform and how they communicated. And I think it's really important to highlight that encrypted communications is an enabler of their crime. By having that platform taken down and to expose that this is the fourth platform that police have had some involvement in that's been taken down and had a huge impact on the criminal environment, that they've got to be feeling quite vulnerable. I think, too, there will be a lot of, mistrust between the syndicates, because whilst we've arrested 250, we are out and about talking to a lot of other people that are on the platform and talking to people in their networks. And my sense is that in that sort of criminal environment, they will be concerned about who's has said what, and there will be a certain level of concern from them, I would imagine, about what we know, that they simply really don't know the extent of our knowledge. They would have some ideas, but I think that would be really unsettling for them, and they would be unsettled about who they can trust in their networks going forward, because there isn't a lot of loyalty in these networks. If there's an opportunity for them to have the position of somebody else, they will take it. You know, they are a violent criminal networks, and it's all about power and ego and money.
Let's turn back the clocks a little bit. Tell me about when you first heard about the plot behind Operation Ironside, and what was your reaction?
So I was one of those people that's known about the platform for a couple of years, just due to some of the roles that I've had in the AFP, and I thought it was really exciting, and then I thought it was, you know, showed a lot of innovation and a lot of courage from a law enforcement organisation to do this.
As those messages started to roll in across the platform, did you ever pinch yourself and shake your head in amazement that it really was working?
I was just excited. I felt like a kid in a candy store, really. You know, it was just that insight into how they do their business. And, you know, we had them taking selfies of themselves and sending them across the platform, which meant for us attribution of who was holding that phone was quite easy. And some of their conversations about, you know, the way they conduct business, it was such an insight. But just the fact that there was no code, you know, when they're talking about money, they talked about the amount. When they're talking about drugs, it was the quantity and where it was coming from and the type. So it was such an interesting thing to be part of, and it really provided us an excellent opportunity to really to clean up a lot of the people that have been causing a lot of harm to Australia and to the international community for quite some time.
That's the AFP's Commander of Investigations in New South Wales, Kirsty Schofield. You're listening to a special edition of The World Today. So one of the most astonishing elements of this story is the way criminal gangs were tricked into using an encryption app they thought was as safe as houses. As we've already heard, that wasn't quite the case. Encryption is great when it works, but not so great when it goes wrong. David Sparks joins me now. He's been taking a look at what encryption is and how it's used. Hi, David. How widely used is it?
Well, Rachel, most of us are using some form of digital encryption in our day-to-day lives without even realising it. I mean, think of your emails, your banking, the list goes on and on. Now, encryption's obviously been taken to new levels by the computer age, but it's actually been going on for thousands of years. In fact, you can go right back to Julius Caesar to find examples of powerful people searching for crafty ways to write uncrackable codes.
That is going back a bit.
Yes. So it's not a new concept at all. Now, I wanted to learn more about encryption, so I went and met with one of the experts in the field. I'm sitting in front of a laptop right now, and on the screen on the laptop is a whole bunch of numbers and letters, which to the untrained eye, which obviously includes me, appears to be complete gibberish. Richard, I hope you've got your explaining shoes on.
Yes, absolutely.
Let's face it, most of us have no idea how encryption works, which is why I'm here with cybersecurity expert Professor Richard Buckland from the University of New South Wales. He's giving me a kind of encryption for dummies lesson. But before we get to the mishmash of computer codes staring me in the face, let's get a few basics out of the way.
The perfect encryption would be you're sending me a message. You write it on a porcelain plate with a waterproof marker. You put it in a sack. You smash it up with a mallet. You send me the sack of all the bits. That is a great code. You've got the message, but you've jumbled it up. And you've jumbled it up in a way that someone that intercepts that sack, it'll be very hard, not impossible, it's never impossible, but it'll be very hard for them to reassemble that message. But the problem with that code is you're sending it to me. When I get it, I can't decode it either. And that is the weakness. That's the fatal flaw in all encryption systems. You have to weaken it so it can be undone.
We think of encryption in terms of the computer age, but it's been around for thousands of years. Everyone from Julius Caesar to the popes, politicians and diplomats of medieval times and the Renaissance have relied heavily on encrypted messages. Professor Buckland says most of those codes were pretty weak and frequently intercepted. In the last century, though, encryption turned to the power of mathematics.
We convert the message into a number, and then we do maths on the number. So mathematics gives us our encryption. So an example of that is if you wanted to say la, the word la, L is the 12th letter of the alphabet, A is the first. So maybe we encode that as a number 1201 or 1201. And maybe your encryption algorithm is to square that. So 1201 squared will be slightly more than a million. And then I'd send you that big number, slightly more than a million. You'd know the secret of how to decode it. You'd square root it. You'd get 1201 back. Then you'd just convert it. It's a code then back into la.
The encryption app Anom, the one police used in its big bust last week, was put out there by the FBI. Anom had crime gangs inadvertently sending their messages straight to the cops.
It looks like it was a reasonable crypto library they were using, if the gossip is right, and they just used it in a bad way, in a weak way.
It sounds like the genius in this Anom scam that the authorities pulled on criminals wasn't so much the encryption technology itself. It was more the psychology, the police work of conning the criminals into trusting it.
Yes, that's exactly right. The humans were the weakest link there.
So let's get back to the encryption code on the screen in front of me.
As I said, this looks like gibberish, but it's not gibberish. What is it? What are we looking at?
All right. This is a program to carry out a form of encryption called AES, and it's pretty much the standard secure way of encrypting things so people can't crack it.
I'm going to read the first line. 0x00, comma, 0x0d, comma, 0x1a, comma. And it goes on in similar fashion. Once again, what on earth is that all about?
The whole idea behind AES is it jumbles up a message in a way that can't be unjumbled, except your intended recipient. So there's one for every possible value of a byte. This is very effective. It was picked by a competition of cryptographers around the world. There were four or five shortlisted, and everyone had a go at hacking and breaking it and trying to attack it and seeing how weak it was. And then since it's come out, people constantly, universities around the world and in intelligence agencies, are constantly trying to break this.
Of course, it's not so effective if you're a criminal and you're using exactly the program the FBI wants you to use. So, in the wake of this bust, will crime gangs stop using encrypted messaging for fear of being tricked again?
In the community, it's widely thought that this bust is being publicised to do precisely that, to make criminals wary of using cryptography. Because the police, intelligence agencies, no one likes it when people use encryption because we can't read their messages. The hope is that the criminals will be frightened to use it.
That's cybersecurity expert Professor Richard Buckland from the University of New South Wales. That report by David Sparks. Operation Ironside has not only exposed weaknesses in Australia's intelligence systems, it shows the aviation and maritime industries are still a big target for drug trafficking and other organised crime. Laws were passed this week aimed at closing up loopholes that have enabled people involved in criminal networks to work in air services and at seaports. Experts warn, despite the massive police sting, drug cartels are likely to already be plotting their next move. Gavin Coote reports.
They're hubs of global trade, so it's no surprise that airports are among the most popular avenues through which criminals are trying to move their products. I'm at Sydney Airport, Australia's busiest airport, and even during COVID-19 times, things are still pretty busy. Masses of passengers and freight are coming and going, and I'm wondering just how much of a target a place like this might be for organised crime. Neil Fergus is a leading intelligence expert, and he spent 20 years in senior roles with the Australian government.
It is the holy grail of compromises for an organised crime group to be able to compromise those systems for the purposes of importing or moving around illicit cargo and predominantly drugs. If they can place somebody who will do their will in an aviation services sector or compromise, blackmail someone to do their will, they have the potential to make many, many millions of dollars with minimal fuss.
The other link in the chain that has experts worried is the country's maritime ports. Here at Port Botany, just near Sydney's airport, millions of cargo items are handled each year. So just how much of this is potentially illegal trade?
In the COVID-19 world, and the dramatic reduction in international passenger traffic, Organised crime cartels are using cargo more than ever before.
And how much of a dent do you think Operation Ironside has put in that level of organised crime within airports and maritime ports?
Look, there's no doubt this has been a great coup, but it's not the end of the war. These gangs are undoubtedly already getting past licking their wounds and thinking about what they've got to do next. So if we're really going to exploit the success of this international law enforcement operation properly, we need to strike now.
Federal Parliament hasn't wasted any time cracking down on organised crime in ports. This week it passed laws that prevent anyone convicted of serious offences or with known links to serious and organised crime groups from getting an identification card and working at airports and seaports. It's something Neil Fergus had recommended in multiple reviews for government. And the Australian Border Force says the tougher background checks will address weaknesses in the system.
Gavin Coote reporting. Well, it's been a story that will no doubt have books written about it, and most likely TV scripts too. It must be something people like Duncan McNabb are considering right now. He's a former police detective, private investigator, and author.
I would imagine a lot of Australia's crims, particularly the very organised ones like outlaw motorcycle gangs and other people in that drug distribution business, have been knocked for six over this. They didn't really expect to have their secure communications cracked, and not cracked in such a creative and smart way. They'll be rocked for a while, but with our drug problems in Australia, the massive market for drugs, someone will cop in to fill the vacuum very, very quickly. It is a competitive market.
Yeah, so what do we know about major police busts of the past? When one layer of a hierarchy is removed, what happens?
That old dreadful cliche, nature does abhor a vacuum. And when you've got a voracious drug trade like we have here, with so many people wanting to use drugs, cocaine and amphetamine bases particularly, and heroin sadly making a return, crooks will always fill the void. Someone else out there will step up as their mates or colleagues have been arrested. Someone else who's sitting on the drugs will move in and start selling to the marketplace again. So, you know, goodbye to old so-and-so down the road who's just been caught, but I can step up to the plate.
What about reprisals? Because essentially these were criminal deals busted open while they were unfolding. So some people out there must be owed a lot of money.
Yeah, I think that is a very interesting point. All of a sudden, someone who's there'll be some people out there who have been arrested who are expecting to get some money in from people they've already on-sold to. They're probably considering their legal options first and their debt recovery options second. There'll be some organisations who have sold drugs on credit and they find out that the person they've sold to has just been locked up. In the pragmatic way of some drug dealers, I just think, you know, we've got so much supply. For example, coming out of Mexico, we'll just take this one on the chin. I think there'll be some reprisals, possibly in the underworld, for people who introduced their mates to phones that were actually being listened in quite happily by the FBI and the AFP. I don't think I'd like to be in their shoes.
Yeah, it really is one of the most audacious ideas for a sting, isn't it? The whole idea of getting criminals to handcuff themselves. It was a good one, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a very elegant piece of investigation. I mean, we've had history of BlackBerry phones were cracked by the DEA in the US, and as a result, people were speaking quite freely on what they thought were secure phones. They got arrested. Along comes the more recent invention, Phantom Secure, which used a BlackBerry phone which had been stripped down and operated in a very specific network. They also got knocked off a couple of years ago. And interestingly enough, and this is what we learned from the FBI, one of the dealers for Phantom Secure phones has come up with the next generation phone, and he's just about to go to market on it when he also gets himself into a bit of strife over something else. He's got a bargaining chip. He knows who the people are who will buy the phone or release it from him, and he also has this next generation technology. So he then on-sells it to the market, but doesn't tell them that he's also done a deal with the FBI. So pretty much their conversations, texts and plots are being BCC'd like an email to law enforcement. It's a remarkably smart move. It puts the coppers literally sitting in the room as the deals are being done with none of the dangers of being an undercover police officer. It's just a lovely piece of investigation.
It is indeed. Well, we hope you've enjoyed this World Today special into Operation Ironside, with reporting from Catherine Gregory, David Sparks and Gavin Coote. If you want to listen back, you'll find the show on the ABC Listen app. Tell your friends to have a listen too. The program was produced by Mike Edwards. Technical production from David Sargent, David Lawford and Ingrid Wagner. I'm Rachel Mealy. Have a great afternoon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.